Joining me today is a true American hero. Former United States Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is here on Defending Democracy. I'm Mark Elias. Let's get started. Welcome, Secretary Clinton, to Defending Democracy.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's wonderful to be with you today.
So I want to start with something that I've been meaning to say to you for some number of years now. It turns out that everything you said about Donald Trump was true. In fact, you were right about everything. And I'm just curious, I'm sure people tell you this all the time, that you were right about everything. I don't know whether you take a certain measure of satisfaction in that. You find it quite depressing that that's true. You wonder why it is people didn't listen more as you were describing what a terrible person Donald Trump would be for the country and for democracy. Like, reflecting back, how do you process having been so much earlier than everybody else to who this guy was?
Well, Mark, it is a question that I get asked on occasion. And the way I think about it is, back in 2016, it was just really hard for people to believe that he could turn out to be such a dangerous, chaotic, vindictive president. And I think a lot of people have kind of suspended their judgment because they liked some of what he said and they didn't take it literally. They mm-hmm. kind of took it as political rhetoric, like, okay, we're going to crack down on the border. We're for that. We want an orderly border. We want security at the border, but we want people to be treated humanely, you know, but so, okay, I'll give the guy a chance. And everything else he said, he also sort of dressed himself in populist clothing, and, you know, made a lot of attacks on traditional Republicans, on corporations, that he was going to deliver a better economy, more and better incomes for people. He went after the Affordable Care Act, but said he was going to produce something much better. And so I think there was confusion on the part of a lot of people and frankly, members of the press who liked covering him because he was so entertaining and maybe weren't following it as closely as I was or understanding the interplay between what he was saying and doing and foreign interests like Russia's or the targeting of people. So they were being manipulated. But, you know, that was 8 years ago. People didn't understand quite how insidious the internet could be in targeting you and feeding you information and getting you addicted and driving you down, you know, rabbit holes by algorithms. So I'm somewhat understanding, I guess I would say, that people couldn't believe what they were hearing would be the literal behavior they would see in the White House. And I thought that, you know, he was telegraphing pretty clearly what he was going to do.
Yeah, look, and I think a lot of people owe you this recognition, this apology. And by the way, I don't just mean Republicans. I mean, Democrats. I think there were a lot of Democrats who, frankly, didn't take it as seriously as they should have. I think the members of the, I think the media really disgraced itself in the way in which it didn't. And so the people who were not following the 2016 campaign closely or don't remember, I want to point out one particular moment because it is like riveted in my mind. I remember standing actually at your campaign headquarters when you gave a speech in August of 2016 to a community college in Nevada. And it was about the alt-right, which I remember listening to you say it. And I'm like, huh, I don't know that I know that term. And you literally walked people through, you know, what Donald Trump and this movement, which at that time seemed very, very, you know, below the surface, what this meant. And, you know, one of the things you said is you said from the start, Donald Trump has built his campaign on prejudice and paranoia. He is taking hate groups mainstream and helping a radical fringe take over the Republican Party. I mean, you were saying it in very, very clear terms, not the terms that politicians oftentimes use where it's very, you know, hedged. You were saying it in very clear terms. And here we are now in 2024. And in fact, that radical fringe has taken over the Republican Party. And I wonder, you know, was there a moment in time, either in 2016 or afterwards, where you thought, you know what, people are just not getting this. People are don't understand how bad this is going to be.
Yeah, no, certainly that was something I thought often, because you're absolutely right. You know, you were part of the campaign. I'm very grateful for your support, your help, your, you know, legal expertise. I gave that speech because I had been studying the rise of the right. You know, I actually said there was a vast right-wing conspiracy at the end of the 1990s because I could see all the interconnections. But, you know, I was looking for it. I was studying it and trying to be historic about it. I knew that there'd been, you know, movements, conservative, fringe, right-wing movements in our nation's history. I knew that there was a very strong effort combining kind of the religious right with the corporate right, with the ideological partisan right to do things like overturn Roe v. Wade and stack the courts with judges of their ideology and views. So I was much more aware of the underlying infrastructure that had been built over a lot of years. What I saw in Trump was someone who had an almost visceral understanding of that dark belly of American politics, that he was great at the dog whistle, appealing to racism and, you know, the anti-immigrant attitudes that he helped to foster. And that he was allied with people like Steve Bannon and others who were almost apocalyptic in their view about what needed to happen to overthrow American culture, not just win political power, but overthrow the culture. And I think that, again, the press was not covering, and most of the people covering that campaign were not particularly knowledgeable about the past and didn't, you know, may not have even known that, you know, America Firsters packed Madison Square Garden in 1939 in a pro-Nazi Germany rally to keep America out of, you know, interfering with Hitler. I mean, people didn't know those things. And so they didn't really take me seriously, to be, I think, very clear about it. And thought that I was exaggerating. You know, I couldn't compete with Trump on the performance stage because I wouldn't go do, say, act the way he did, which kept them riveted and kept, you know, them covering empty podiums until he showed up. I, you know, that's not me. I wasn't going to do it. I don't think that's who should be elected president. So when I would give a serious speech, whether it was about the future of the Supreme Court, which I gave in Madison, Wisconsin, or this speech you're talking about, concerning the alt-right, the far right wing movement to, you know, prop up Trump and win. I think people thought I was probably, you know, exaggerating, making it up. So, you know, it just didn't jibe with how people either thought about the election or in terms of reporters covered the election.
Well, so fast forward now to the end of 2020. The beginning of 2021, and Donald Trump loses his election. And everyone who is sensible knows he loses his election. In fact, Fox News says he lost the election at this point.
They called it, remember? They called it. Yeah.
Yeah, they called the election, right? But yeah. Donald Trump and his sycophants are continuing to say he didn't, and they are litigating in court. My team and I are representing at that point President Biden and fighting those cases. Right. And there continued to be in the media, and I don't want this to just be bash the media, but it's just fact. There continued to be in the media this sense of, well, he just needs to burn off a little bit of energy.
Donald being Donald, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
exactly.
When did you, you know, start to think, you know what, this is not going to end with a concession speech by Donald Trump. This is not going to end normally or well.
You know, Mark, it's really interesting because if you can remember, you might be one of the few people who could, the last debate I had with Trump in 2016, he then started to say that if he didn't win, it would be rigged. He began to cast doubt on the validity of our elections. And I remember being so shocked and responding like, what are you talking about? I mean, one of the great hallmarks of our democracy is the peaceful transition of power. So that actually happened in the third debate. Again, no coverage of it, but I kept that in the back of my head. And you know, one of the other reasons I should add that people, you know, didn't cover me so much. They kept thinking I was going to win literally until the very end. So it was like, oh, well, you know, this guy's more entertaining. She'll be president. That's fine. So you fast forward to 2020. I think from what I've heard, Trump was totally caught off guard that he had lost the Electoral College, because they had done everything they could in the prior 4 years, starting in 2017, with the help of Republican governors, secretaries of state, legislatures, to do everything they could to try to make sure they couldn't lose. And he might, you know, have lost the popular vote again, like he did to me in 2016, but he was confident he was going to win the Electoral College. In fact, I know that, you know, some people very close to him, you know, basically were telling folks that running up to the 2020 election that Biden will probably win the popular vote. But remember, it doesn't matter because, you know, I won without the popular vote before. And because the margins were so narrow in Georgia, Arizona, you know, it really was a very close election in the Electoral College, even though Biden blew him out in the popular vote. I think
as you did, by the way.
I did, yeah. But think about this, and you've got a sophisticated audience. So in you know, in 2016, I won by nearly 3 million votes, right? But I lost the key electoral states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin by 77,000 votes. So, you know, a 39,000 vote turn would have made all the difference. So along comes the 2020 election, and President Biden wins by 7.5 million votes. But he wins the Electoral College by 100,000 votes. So think about how narrow a margin that is. And that's the bet that Trump and his enablers were making. And because it was close in the Electoral College, not in the popular vote, they thought, I think some of them might have been deluded enough to think, you know, oh my God, the Democrats have cheated us, which, you know, is so ridiculous in large measure because Republicans were running the states that they were worried about. But even if they couldn't prove that, it was an article of faith, and they were going to do everything they could to upend that election result. And, you know, you litigated against these people all over the country. They are now saying things like, if Trump doesn't win, it's not a fair election.
Right.
I mean, really, who believes that except cult members? And that's what they are.
So what's your advice? You know, I'm sure you've offered your advice privately to President Biden.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people seek your counsel all the time. You know, you have this backdrop. You have been sort of a prophet, frankly. You have seen what Donald Trump is going to do before he has done it, probably more than any other person there is. So now you're saying in 2024, you're hearing them say this, which we all are. So what is the, like, what, how does this end? You know, like, how do we get from here to normalcy or something, you know, in 2025?
Well, let me start with the good news. And the good news is that with really only, you know, a few exceptions, Democrats are running the elections in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania. They have
in Arizona.
In Arizona, they have, you know, the governor in North Carolina. Nevada has a Republican governor, but Democratic office holders elsewhere. So
including Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, which is, as you know, the office that runs elections. So the good news is that I think you'll get fair results, you know, and we have to accept those results because Democrats are basically trying to call the shots. That's, you know, not the case in Georgia, but, you know, the governor there rose to the occasion in 2020. Let's, you know, hope that he does again. So here's what I think is the game that they are playing. You know this better than anybody. They are trying to narrow the electorate. They are purging votes as quickly as they can purge votes. And they are, legislatures are sometimes forcing Democratic office holders to do things in order to, you know, get along with them on other matters. And I know from 2016, I think this is accurate still, Mark, is that, take one area, I got more votes, I got a higher percentage of the votes in Cleveland in 2016 than President Obama had gotten, but the electorate had so shrunk that my higher percentage was fewer votes. And so that's the number one thing. Purge voters. Have a whole system of raising challenges, of, you know, stopping at every turn people who have every legitimate reason to be able to vote. Secondly, have intimidation at the polls. Go after people who are trying to vote. Make it difficult for them. Challenge their vote. Force them to cast a provisional vote. They have a lot of games they play, which you have been litigating against for years now. But they're going to do everything they can to throw a spanner into the works. And that's on the sort of election, you know, operation side of the ledger. This is what they want to do to try to mix it up, make it difficult, cause problems. On the messaging side, I don't even know yet, probably can't even imagine what they're going to do with artificial intelligence and other cyber attacks on voters in terms of the messages that they will get, sometimes deliberately to confuse them, you know, different polling places, different days to vote, different times of voting. I mean, whatever they can do to mess people up. We already had an example of that in the Democratic primary with, you know, somebody doing a phony robocall from President Biden telling them, you know, not to vote on a certain day. So I think they're going to dramatically increase their confusion operation in terms of aimed at voters to get them, you know, somewhat discouraged by the complexity of voting or the they're not knowing what they should do. And then finally, look, I think they're going to be very effective in their disinformation campaigns. And you know, they were good against me, and they're still repeating the lies they told about me in 2016 to rev up their base, you know, whether it's Pizzagate or, you know, all these other crazy, you know, things they said. So I think there's going to be a three-pronged strategy: shrink the electorate, make it difficult to vote, confuse people about voting, make it hard for them to understand what they're supposed to do, discredit mail-in votes, all of that, and then just flat-out disinformation. And I would assume they will have some, you know, big surprises toward the end that they are going to try to launch against the president.
So you have seen this from every perspective. You obviously, your husband was president. You were a senator. You were a secretary of state. You served in President Obama's cabinet. You know, one of the things that strikes me that you say here that is that, you know, there was a time not that long ago when popular mandates were really important to politicians. You know, Ronald Reagan would brag not about his electoral college wins, but about his popular mandate.
Exactly.
You know, your husband, I remember in 1997, after he won re-election, talked about what winning a mandate of the popular vote meant for his ability to govern. You know, people don't realize, but Bob Dole, who was a senator and also former RNC chair, not a bipartisan figure, especially early in his time during Watergate, he actually took to the floor of the Senate in 1972 and said, of course, the American people would be ill-served if the person who won the popular vote didn't win the presidency because of this importance of the popular will being behind the president. And I think the media did a really disservice to people in 2017 because they would talk about the Trump, you know, the Trump voters and how Trump had won a majority of the, but he didn't. He lost the popular vote. And he lost it more in 2020. And I know you have been Secretary of State. You've seen democracies around the world. Like I said, you've obviously seen it here. Am I right to think there is a danger in a political party, in the Republican Party, you know, trying to make it harder to vote and easier to cheat so they can win power with ever smaller shares of the electorate? Like, yeah. Isn't that mandate idea kind of important to governing?
Well, you would think so, but they're more interested in populism than in the popular majority. And their idea of winning is at any cost to do whatever is necessary and to shrink the electorate so that they win in the Electoral College, because honestly, I don't think they could win a popular vote in any election up and coming. But they have a different view about what they're doing. They are running to win, not to validate and respect the process that we have built up over, you know, nearly 250 years to try to figure out how to do this right. They are winning to implement an agenda. And that was always pretty clear, but now they actually have one. It's, you know, Project 2025. They have right-wing think tanks and others working on putting together what Trump will do. So nobody should be surprised. It's all written down what he's going to do from day one forward, and he telegraphs and talks about it all the time. So honestly, I think it is really quite distressing to see someone who doesn't really care whether he wins the popular vote. Obviously, he'd love to, everybody would love to, but that's not the goal. The goal is to win power. And what happened after the 2020 election is that he was so angry and shocked that he hadn't won, as he had been led to believe he would win, that he put our country through this prolonged trauma. And he kept, as he is,
An insurrection.
Well, he's a bully. And he thinks that if he bullies you enough, and it's worked with the Republican Party, it certainly has worked with the House Republicans, as we see every day now. If he bullies you enough, you will give in. So if he disrupts the process, if he sends his, you know, followers to the Capitol to try to disrupt the counting of the votes, if he tries to have fake electors, everything he's done, calling up, you know, state officials, asking them to find more votes, which literally means go be like Vladimir Putin and make up votes so that I end up winning. That's all fair game to him, because all that matters to him, his enablers, his amplifiers, his supporters, is that he wins. And it doesn't matter to them how it happens.
Okay. You mentioned earlier a speech you gave during the 2016 campaign about the Supreme Court. And I can't let our time expire without asking you, you were, for people who don't know, you were a very, very, very prominent and successful national lawyer before you came to Washington, D.C. So you have seen the bench from the standpoint of a lawyer. You were a U.S. senator, which is really a unique perch on understanding the Supreme Court, because you get to vote on and examine and really hear what goes into being a federal judge. And, you know, you predicted, again, you were right about everything. You predicted what we would see with the court. And one of the things that has worried me is not only have we seen the rollback in civil rights in Shelby County and in the Dobbs decision, the attack on abortion rights, but recently the court seems to be putting its thumb on the scale for Donald Trump in some really meaningful and important ways. You know, obviously it found that notwithstanding the findings of a trial court and a state court in Colorado, that he was not disqualified, which seemed like a real stretch. I mean, they seem to go a long travel there away from originalism to get to that result. On the Trump immunity cases, the case involving, you know, what is really just a frivolous theory on his part that he somehow is immune from prosecution, they scheduled this thing so that they seem to be trying to help him run out the clock. What do you, from having seen the Supreme Court and the federal courts from all these vantage points, what would you tell people to make of the current composition and what they're doing to help Donald Trump?
Well, what the majority is doing is what they were put on the court to do. Mm-hmm. Right. They are implementing a right-wing agenda, regardless of legislative action, legislative history, any kind of constraint that stands in the way of them getting to the result that is in line with the kind of conservative manifesto about rolling back federal power, unleashing corporate power, holding the Second Amendment sacrosanct above all other, you know, parts of our Constitution, which is not an originalist view at all. And then, of course, the poorly reasoned, poorly written Dobbs decision.
An outrage. Outrage, overturning years, decades of precedent.
Well, and it was also, it was so clearly results oriented. Mm-hmm. It didn't even pretend to take on the arguments in a thoughtful, serious way. You know, I taught law many years ago. It would not have passed muster if it had been an assignment in my, you know, law school teaching. You know, I was in the Senate when both John Roberts and Alito were nominated to the court by George W. Bush. Therefore, I had a chance, as you rightly say, to interview both of them. And I found John Roberts to be a kind of conservative, corporate-oriented lawyer who had a kind of preconceived notion of the way things and people should work. Like, I want people to be colorblind. So that's the kind of society I am going to try to make happen, which means ignoring generations, centuries of discrimination in oppressing Black people in our country, because this is what I want. I mean, it was almost an almost kind of intentional naivete, if you will, that really came across to me. Likeable. If I sat next to him at a dinner party, probably would have had a really nice conversation, but I voted against him. And I voted against him because I thought he was, you know, not only a candidate of the far right, the Federalist Society and their agenda, but that his life experience was just too narrow to really be in that position. Alito struck me almost immediately upon sitting down to talk with him as a radical, as a fanatic about his views of culture and the role of religion in our society and his religion, not maybe yours or mine, Marx, but his religion. And I found him scary. And I said so on the floor of the Senate when I voted against him. So I, you know, knew that this was on the march. I went to law school with Clarence Thomas. It wasn't like I was surprised. But then with the Gorsuch appointment and, you know, what that led to, especially in the face of Mitch McConnell preventing any nomination from Barack Obama to even be considered, which was a total break with precedent, just hardball results-oriented politics. And we got, you know, we got that. And then we got, you know, Amy Coney Barrett. So we got the judges that had been groomed, put into the pipeline, to do what they are now doing.
Yeah. So I have to ask you one last question. And I'm sure people ask you this a lot in different formulations, because you have been right about everything.
You were saying that. I mean, you know, that my grandchildren would laugh at that.
So there are a lot of people out there who are disillusioned by the political process. They are upset about this or that, or they just feel like politics isn't working for them. And, you know, one of the things that the Republicans are able to do in voter suppression, both by making voting harder, people say, why go through the trouble? Or through disinformation and misinformation, they are able to dissuade people from voting. But for people who come up to you and say, look, you know, I feel like you were cheated. You know, I think that your election was not on the up and up because Russia was in, you know, Russia got involved and Donald Trump and you know, and all that. And yeah, I voted for President Biden in 2020, but you know, we lived through Trump. Trump didn't, you know, we made it through him once. Why, you know, and it wasn't great, but we survived. Why should I continue to be engaged in this process? Why shouldn't I just, you know, say, it's not for me, this voting thing, or I should cast a protest vote? Like, what do you tell people about what is at stake here if they think they made it through Trump once and, you know, they'll survive it again?
Well, the first thing I say is I'm for Joe Biden on the merits. I think he's done a good job as president, and I often rattle off the many things that I agree with and that were difficult to get through a divided Congress, which he did, and which is helping to reshape our future, whether it's infrastructure or the price of prescription drugs or getting competitive with China on science, with the CHIPS bill. I mean, everything you can, you know, see that is in process, thanks to the Biden administration, I think is very positive for America. Now, the results are not always blaring in great big neon lights, but we're laying a very strong grounding. And I think maybe even more importantly, he's modeling responsible leadership, which is not flashy, not engaging in vitriolic attacks on people, you know, in rallies and online, not threatening to execute people and putting them in jail. And the kind of threats that you hear coming out of Donald Trump should scare every American, because with an authoritarian, you never know what side of the bed they'll wake up on. You never know who they're going to be upset with today. You never know if somebody, you know, basically bribes them by giving business to a relative or, you know, some other gift, that they will try to destroy one business to advantage another. You just never know, because they don't believe in the rule of law. They don't believe in institutions. And therefore, if you give them a chance to be more unfettered than he was in his first term, when he was trying to figure out what he could do, and he had actually some people around who were restraining him, that is all going to be gone. If he ever gets back near the White House again, it will be like having a dictator. And I don't say that lightly, but go back and read Project 2025. They're going to fire everybody. Oh, the person in, you know, the government who knows about what may be the next pandemic, get rid of him. He didn't vote for me, or I don't, you know, like the way he looks. I mean, just think about the chaos and the instability that we got through with COVID, although it cost hundreds of thousands more lives than it should have, because he was such an inept leader when we needed somebody to really grab hold and guide us through this unprecedented global pandemic. So I think people who say, well, I'm not enthusiastic, I don't know what difference it would make, and they say, oh, you know, Joe Biden's old. I always say, look, you're right. Joe Biden is old. He's also effective. He's compassionate. He cares about people. He wants to maintain our democracy. He will abide by the results of a fair and free election. And Donald Trump is old, and he has 91 felony criminal indictments against him. And in a court of law, it's not just rhetoric. You got to step up and prove evidence. That's one of the reasons you win so many cases, Mark, because the other side is in there just, you know, carrying on, you know, making claims they can't prove. And you actually step up and you got facts and you got evidence. How novel. And you win because you have a better case. This man has been indicted 91 times. And do we really expect him to govern in a stable, appropriate, rules-based, respectful way? Of course not. And if you're somebody who thinks, well, yeah, but he's entertaining and politics is boring and, you know, I don't know what they do anyway, you cannot think like that in this election, no matter what issue you care about. I don't care what it is. You will find that the next president will have some influence on that. And you want somebody, at the very least, who will try to find what the facts are and make decisions that are evidence-based. And finally, I think we haven't talked much about the international arena, but, you know, his bromance with Putin, and it was actually called that, I think, by the former prime minister of Australia, who said he saw Trump with Putin, and Trump was like, you know, just gaga over Putin, because Putin does what he would like to do, kill his opposition, imprison his opposition, drive, you know, journalists and others into exile, rule without any check or balance. That's what Trump really wants. And so we have to be very conscious of how he sees the world, because in that world, he only sees strong men leaders. He sees Putin. He sees Xi. He sees Kim Jong-un in North Korea. Those are the people he is modeling himself after. And we've been down this road in our, you know, world history. We sure don't want to go down that again. And especially when my view, having negotiated with Putin and knowing that one of the reasons he went after me is because he knew I would, you know, deal with him in an appropriate way, and Trump would basically do whatever he wanted. It's really important to think about what could happen to our world with Trump back in the White House, withdrawing us from NATO, not caring about what happens in Europe, our biggest trading partner, the place where we share values with, the idea that he wants Ukraine to fail, the idea that he doesn't want us to be able to surveil our enemies. I mean, this is a very scary prospect.
Yeah, you were an extraordinary Secretary of State. I mean, one of the greatest Secretary of States in our country, in part because you believed in the American ideal of democracy and supporting our allies and building international consensus, but also you believed in opposing our enemies. You know, you told Vladimir Putin who he was. You were clear-eyed about what the threats the country are and to democracy. And so I said the last was my last question, but you opened the door, so I'm going to ask this. How much damage has Donald Trump done permanently to, you know, I think about, you know, no offense to Secretary of State Blinken, but it strikes me you had Donald Trump injured the American brand. You know, and a lot of what the Secretary of State has is that around issues around democracy and fairness and liberalism and women's rights and, you know, expanding the rights of people and talking to other countries about what they needed to do. And how much do you feel like this is a transitory damage that he's done, or do you think this is like a permanent damage that he's done?
I think he did damage exactly as you describe, really undermined our credibility. But I do think Biden has done a really remarkable job in repairing a lot of that, you know, putting together the alliance, the NATO alliance again, to try to, you know, support Ukraine and stand against Russia, putting together Pacific alliances. As you and I were talking before we began, I was at the White House for a state dinner with the Japanese prime minister, South Korea, Japan, Australia, the Philippines, India. The Biden administration has really worked hard to get them into a working alliance in order to deter China's most aggressive intentions. So I think it was really difficult for Biden and Blinken and others to come in following Trump, and they had to quickly, you know, literally go around the world reassuring people, but they've done a good job of that. But I've spent a lot of time in Europe. I was at something called the Munich Security Conference in February. All I did was try to reassure European allies. And I'm talking about, you know, not just the big countries like, you know, Germany and France. I'm talking about the Scandinavian countries, the Baltic countries, Poland, places that really understand Russian aggression historically and Vladimir Putin's particular brand of it. And they have no illusions. If Putin is successful in Ukraine, they're coming after Poland. I mean, the foreign minister of
you really Poland, think so? You think you think they?
I'm telling you what he said to me. Yeah. He said to me, and he gave me some citations. He said, "Read the speeches that Putin is now making about Poland, in which he is questioning the legitimacy of Polish borders." Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you talk to the leaders of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and particularly this young woman prime minister in Estonia, whose mother and grandmother were deported by the Soviets into Siberia, it took years for them to get back, she has no illusions. And the United States, kind of in Trump's worldview, would let Putin do whatever he wants to do in Europe. That would be the most serious geopolitical failure since Munich in world, you know, leading up to World War II, when Neville Chamberlain came back and said, oh, I think if we give, you know, Hitler this, you know, a little bit, he'll be happy and we don't have to worry about him anymore. That is not who you're dealing with. You're dealing with an aggressive dictator who wants to, you know, really conquer and hold a lot of territory, because in Putin's case, it's how he views the former Soviet Union and the Russian Empire, but it's also because they have assets. They have natural resources. They have access to seas. They have technological capacity better than Russia's. I mean, this is old-fashioned great power conflict, and Russia is playing an old game, and we're not understanding the full implication of it. But the Europeans are standing firm in large measure because they do see what a direct threat it is to them. And I believe it is also a direct threat to us. That's not how Trump is talking. You know, he really doesn't understand enough history to have an informed opinion, but it wouldn't matter anyway, because he wants to be on the side of, you know, the big guys. And the final thing I'd say about this, Mark, is, you know, he's not a very good negotiator. you know, a lot of people in real estate that I know here in New York would tell me these crazy stories, but he would always pretend. And then he was on a pretend television show, making him look like a great businessman. But the bottom line is, he's easily bullied and he's easily flattered. And he also only is concerned about himself, not the country. So if you're a smart enough dictator sitting in Moscow or Beijing or even Pyongyang, bullying and flattering, those are pretty easy strategies to carry out.
Well, Secretary Clinton, thank you for being here. You, as I said, you are one of my heroes in American politics, in international affairs, in frankly just observing, you know, the country. As you said, you know, the attacks not just on our legal system and our political system, but on our culture that we have seen. And you have been, as I said, you have been right about everything. So thank you for everything you've done for the country. Thank you for everything you've done for me personally. And thank you for being on the podcast.
Well, look, right back at you, Mark. I admire you. You're a great lawyer. And truly, you have been on the front lines of saving our democracy and, you know, enabling people to actually vote and have their votes counted. And we need you now as much as ever. So I know it must be stressful and exhausting to be on the front lines like you are, but please just keep going. We got to get through this next election, because we'll either continue our democracy or we'll lose it.
Well, either way,
I think that's the choice.
Let's hope we continue it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for joining us today on Defending Democracy. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a review. And to find out more and stay up to date on the latest voting rights and election news, visit democracydocket.com and make sure you are subscribed to our daily and weekly newsletters. We'll see you next time. Today's episode was produced by Ali Rothenberg, Gabby Corporal, and Paige Moskowitz. It was edited by Gabby Corporal and Paige Moskowitz. Defending Democracy is a production of Democracy Docket, LLC.